From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Fillmore.
I'm from San Jose.
I'm from the Intermission.
UCCC World.
West Oakland.
East Oakland.
Coming up, we'll take you to a tiny oasis in the middle of the Tenderloin.
And I seen this place and I stopped. I moonwalked back and I said, oh my gosh. And the gate was open. I walked in and I'm like, oh, how beautiful. I was like, shh.
Also, we'll see how space was created for many of San Francisco's public parks.
It really was a kind of game of one-upsmanship. We want to put this West Coast city on the map, so we want a Central Park, too.
And we'll meet one Richmond resident who is cultivating green space and community in the city's toughest neighborhood.
I want to go back, and I want to, like, give it my all, you know, and just pour it all out.
Discover the secret gardens of the Bay Area with us today on Cross Currents. The Tenderloin is not exactly known as a tender place to live. It's the densest neighborhood in San Francisco, home to roughly 30,000 people. That's 750 per square block. And many are low-income immigrants and families living in tall apartments, homeless shelters, or single-room occupancy hotels. Some, with nowhere else to go, live right on the street. You're more likely to hear police sirens than birds or other wildlife in the Tenderloin. That's partly because this is an area of high crime, but also because there's very little green space here. But that hasn't stopped some Tenderloin residents who've invited nature into their lives in the most unexpected of places. KLW's Ali Budner takes us to a place known to residents as the Tenderloin National Forest.
So can we go on a little tour here?
Sure. Right now we're standing in front of a more arid desert kind of feature.
The street sounds don't let you forget you're in the heart of the Tenderloin. But as soon as you set foot in this park, you know you've walked into a unique space.
There's the hummingbird again.
That's Daryl Smith, my tour guide.
And I'm co-founder, director of the Luggage Store Gallery with my partner, Lori Laser.
Together, they founded this place, the Tenderloin National Forest. It's off of Ellis Street between Hyde and Leavenworth. And let's be real, it's still a concrete alley sandwiched between tall brick buildings. But if you let yourself zoom in on what's in here, it really can feel like a verdant oasis. Trees and plants of all colors and sizes surround us. A water fountain filled with bright orange fish bubbles in one corner. A neon sign hangs over a shed with a living grass roof. It reads in cursive script, "Tell your stories here." An earthen oven, giant colorful murals on every wall. My favorite touch is the arrowhead-shaped greeting sign that looks a lot like the traditional National Forest logo.
It's comforting. It's very, very comforting. And it's very serene.
That's Frankie Madison. He comes here to relax.
In this chaotic city now, it's nice to have a little quiet place to be. Especially here in the Tenderloin, I mean, everything is so upside down and backwards that to step through that gate and to come in here, you just transcend to a different place. You're not in the Tenderloin anymore.
But if you had peered into this alley 15 years ago or so, you would have seen a very different picture. Again, Daryl Smith.
It was all asphalt. It was a classic inner city alleyway. There was a lot of garbage, a lot of, you know, excrement, drug paraphernalia. It was like kind of, you know, it had its own story.
Which is in part the story of the Tenderloin itself.
It was a very dense and very mixed part of the city from very early on without a lot of provision for open space.
That's Ben Grant. He works with SPUR, an urban planning nonprofit in San Francisco. He can think of only one substantial public park in the Tenderloin, Bodecker Park, built in the mid-80s. But it has tall metal fences and iron benches. It's not that welcoming.
I think the contrast between Bodecker Park and the Tenderloin National Forest really reveals the importance of local stewardship and community advocates, especially in a district that has, you know, significant problems with homelessness, with substance abuse, with social issues.
So how did they do it? How do you create green space where there's practically none? In the 1980s, artists Daryl Smith and Lori Laser were living and working in the Tenderloin, right near this alley. Then it was called Cohen Place. And at that time, Smith says the alley received an average of 1,000 police calls a year. So in the early 90s, they started a public art series there. They called it Performance in the Gutter.
And so we clean up and then, you know, we do installations and have performances go on here just to kind of give a sense of what could be, you know, what the possibilities could be if we could, like, kind of turn it around.
But they couldn't do it right away. First, they reached out to their neighbors for ideas and support. Then they went to local nonprofits that helped them with research, planning, and connections so they could approach city government. A decade later, the city agreed to lease them the space for $1 a year. Then they knew they could really build something. But they started small.
So this redwood that we call Mama Tender was the first tree that we brought here to live.
And that's how it started. One tree, which is now four stories tall, by the way. As it grew, so did their vision. One day, they laid out a blanket of grass for an event. When they were about to pack it up,
somebody in the Senator Hotel just kind of whispered out the window, like, keep it. You know, I was like, wow. Well, that planted the seed, really.
And that's when the alleyway really started to change.
Garbage collector trucks didn't come in here anymore.
And when there was an emergency,
the fire department said, you know, we'll just bring in hoses and ladders. We don't need to pull a truck in.
These changes allowed the alley to flourish. Today, there's all kinds of trees. Pine, maple, lemon, olive, ginkgo. And not one, but two redwoods. From cacti and succulents to bamboos and ferns, sages, rosemary, lavender, mint. The diversity of plant life in this small space is astounding. Anne Thomas was caught by surprise when she first saw the forest.
I was walking really fast and I was like really upset because I had to search for a bed. And I seen this place and I stopped. I moonwalked back and I said, oh my gosh. And the gate was open. I walked in. I'm like, oh, how beautiful. I was like, shh. And it was like, oh, everything is so cute. And I was like, oh, I wish I could bake something in that oven.
Right?
You know, because you can bake food here. It's just gorgeous. And I thank God that this place is here.
Founder Daryl Smith says the neighbors have really embraced the forest.
The neighborhood's, over the years, has gotten much more involved in it, like taking care of it, watching over it.
But the park's most frequent visitors are the hummingbirds.
The hummingbird is kind of a magical bird.
It's the only bird that can fly backwards, and it has the largest heart in the animal kingdom relative to its size. But also,
it's the link, you know, it's sort of from green pocket to green pocket. Like, how does it get here? There's a whole, like, system of green pockets that, that it ties together in its flight pattern. So they started coming here after we began greening the alley.
During my visit, a few ruby-throated hummingbirds flickered in. They'd hover for a sweet moment, then flicker away. Kind of like the neighbors who wander in and out of this space. For now, it's forest enough. From the Tenderloin National Forest, I'm Allie Budner for Cross Currents.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. The Tenderloin National Forest is obviously much loved and some would argue even needed as a respite from the dense concrete jungle of the Tenderloin neighborhood. So if access to parks, greenery, and open spaces makes such a profound difference for people living in cities, then who decides where, how, and when they're placed? Why, for example, did the Tenderloin never get a spacious park back when it was first being built? And how did our greener neighborhoods get so lucky? We just heard Ben Grant from the San Francisco Planning and Urban Research Association talk about the Tenderloin National Forest with Allie Budner. In this next story, Budner asks Grant to answer some questions about the history of San Francisco's parks.
My name is Benjamin Grant, and I'm the public... I always have to remember what my title is because it's long. Let's look at my card.
When he finds his card, I see why he has trouble remembering his title. Benjamin Grant is the Public Realm and Urban Design Program Manager at the San Francisco Planning and Urban Research Association, also known as Spur.
So I work on public space and the physical form of the city.
He also knows quite a bit about the history of parks in the Bay Area.
I would say that the process by which parks come into being is different over different periods of history. But of course, it's always easier to put a park in as you're building a city than it is to put a park in after the fact.
Right. That's why creating new parks in areas like the Tenderloin today is so hard.
The sort of grand parks that the 19th century gave us, Central Park, Golden Gate Park, things like this, were generally laid out before the city was built around them.
Okay, so Golden Gate Park is a good example, San Francisco's largest and most famous park. Let's find out how that one happened.
Golden Gate Park was the vision of this sort of cadre of city fathers at the time, and it mostly was fathers of people that had that were, you know, many of them industrialists or had business interests, but had a real stake in the sort of the reputation of the city.
Central Park had just been built, and it became the crown jewel of New York City.
It really was a kind of game of one-upsmanship. But we want to put this West Coast city on the map, so we want a Central Park too.
And we got one. Those so-called city fathers hired Frederick Law Olmsted, the designer of Central Park, to build a close replica of New York's crown jewel right here in San Francisco.
He took one look at the outside lands, the windswept sand dunes where Golden Gate Park now resides, and said, no, that's a completely inappropriate place for this sort of grand romantic garden landscape that is essentially modeled on the British countryside.
Instead, Olmsted proposed a series of smaller parks connected by a greenway throughout the city. But
the city fathers were not impressed. They wanted Central Park and they wanted it now. So they sent Olmsted on his way, and they got William Hammond Hall, who was sort of the mind behind Golden Gate Park, to begin to convert that landscape from sand dunes to the facsimile of Central Park.
Which was then developed into its current state by Park Superintendent John McLaren. So we have Golden Gate Park as we know and love it today. More than 1,000 acres of trees, rolling hills, and meadows with lakes, waterfalls, and windmills. Golden Gate Park was clearly motivated by prestige. But what about the rest of our parks? Some, like Sutro Heights over the Pacific Ocean, were willed to the city by wealthy landowners. Others were planned into the original city grid.
Like Alamo Square.
And Jefferson Square. Both intended to be neighborhood centers. Then in the 70s, former military installations were turned into parks.
And so a lot of them are in Headlands, Fort Miley and Land's End, the Presidio, Angel Island.
Land can also open up for parks by chance, like after natural disasters.
And I think you see an interesting example of that in the city. And one of the newer parks in San Francisco is Hayes Green on Octavia, which was built on in the right-of-way of the Central Freeway, which was destroyed in the 1989 earthquake.
But what if we want to build brand new parks today without having to wait for an earthquake or a rich person to donate land? That's within the purview of the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency,
which is in charge of redeveloping land that has been used for other purposes in the past, like the Mission Bay area, which was an industrial rail yard historically.
That's pretty large scale. A new category of parks that don't take as much money or effort are parklets.
A group called Rebar sort of reimagined a parking space with a parking meter as a short-term lease, that you pay the meter and you purchase the right to use this space. Well, why do you have to store a car on it?
Now there's actually a permit process in the city by which anyone can turn a parking space into a parklet. But back to our original question. Where does a park like the Tenderloin National Forest fit into all of this?
There's a whole other model, I think, of public space that is really about this kind of bottom-up process where a local person sees an opportunity, makes it happen, stewards it through the kind of maze of permissions and public spaces or a public process, and creates a little gem. And I think the Tenderloin National Forest is a wonderful example of that. And you see that also in a number of community gardens, both in San Francisco and in other cities, where local people have seen an opportunity and really turned it into something special.
Parks are something special in the city. And as with many creative endeavors, they take vision and resources to come about. In San Francisco, I'm Allie Budner for Cross Currents.
How important is green space in your neighborhood? Do you know of a place that could use a park? You can let us know by giving us a call at 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106.
This is Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. From creating public spaces in parking spots to secret parks hidden between residential hotels, people around the Bay Area are finding ways to bring nature into their urban environment. But there's one little piece of nature that we don't need to coax into our midst. Raccoons. Last November, we brought you the story of Dan Ryan's battles with our furry neighbors.
You know, you get in your head that this thing is out there, and you get kind of paranoid about it, and you start feeling like it's me against the raccoons, and they're out to get me. And so you start then cooking up little solutions in your head, whether it be calling the exterminator guy or buy an electric fence or secretly designing weapons in your head.
Well, a lot of you sympathized with Ryan and called in with your own stories about these now urban animals and their feathered counterparts.
My neighbor, he got real upset with the raccoons because they were coming through the cat door into his kitchen and eating the cat food. And one night his kitty, Gracie, came home all ripped up and had to be taken to their emergency vet at 2 in the morning. So Dave put out a trap for the raccoons, and he caught a young raccoon in it. However, when he went out to inspect the catch in his trap, there was a whole family of raccoons standing around there. And Dave became so agitated that he let the raccoon in the trap go. When he told me about this, I said, "Let me get this straight, Dave. The score is Dave 0, raccoons 1, right?" So they can be annoying.
Next message.
I am calling about is the increase of ravens, gigantic ravens. Ravens aren't scared of anything, and they're very smart. What I've seen is they have no natural predators, and yet they are exterminating all the little birds and eating all the rodents. And I actually think that we have too many ravens, and somebody should do something about it. Of course, we live in a community where virtually every animal is protected. I know we have a lot of skunks in my neighborhood, and nobody would be willing to remove them. But ravens, I find very scary.
End of message.
You heard from listeners Norman Hirsch and Beth Heisler. They shared their stories with us, and we'd like you to do that, too. You can give us a call at 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message. That number again is 415-264-7106, and we'll try to get your call on the air. We've been talking today about finding unexpected green spaces, from San Francisco's Tenderloin District to Richmond's Iron Triangle neighborhood. Richmond is notorious for its high crime rate and industrial pollution. And the Iron Triangle, which is bordered on three sides by train tracks, just might be the city's most dangerous neighborhood. But inside the triangle, activist Tanya Pulido is cultivating community and social consciousness through the Berryland Community Garden. Pulido is one of the winners of the 2011 David Brower Youth Awards. She joined me in studio.
I'm the firstborn generation here in the U.S.
Where are your parents from?
Mexico. And there's a lot of immigrants that live close to the Richmond Greenway, and they just have a wealth of knowledge about farming and plants. So it's just been such a great pleasure to be able to hear, like, all their knowledge and them wanting to help out. So in some cases, it's been really easy. And other cases, and particularly with the youth, it's been a little bit harder to convince them because, as you know, as we talked about, there's so many other issues with violence and drugs and other things that, you know, trying to save the environment is not at the top of their list. But just, you know, something I've been doing is like working with different organizations. So I work with the RISE Center, that is a youth center in Richmond that does popular education. I'm working with Urban Tilled, and Urban Tilled is just like a it's just a wonderful organization because 80% of our employees are under the age of 25. So a lot of the people managing the gardens and the farms are 20, 21. You know, the people I work with, one is 16, the other one's 20. So definitely, I think one of our strategies to get people involved is by actually hiring people near the gardens, you know.
And you also said that you're reaching out specifically to young mothers.
Yeah, young mothers, there's a lot of young mothers in Richmond, and I've been working a lot with mothers, period, and like young children, children, period, and because the garden is right next to Lincoln Elementary, so it's, you know, it's ideal, and we talk to mothers there, you know, and children love to join, you know, the activities, because we have art activities, so they love to be part of that, and then we give them tours, and we give them, like, a little bag, and we're tasting things as we go along, and they just love that, and yeah, I definitely feel that, you know, after working with youth for like almost 2 years, I've definitely saw, you know, that mothers, you know, who doesn't care about their children, you know, and I feel like what I can do is like be a bridge, you know, because little kids look up to high school kids, you know, and they're like, they think they're the coolest thing ever. And then, you know, it's hard for mothers to get to their high school children, you know. And then so the way I see it is like by getting people involved my age to help me organize and to organize events and stuff, you know, I'm actually creating this bridge between generations that, you know, because I really want this to be like a community, you know. I don't want to target one specific group because I know, you know, it affects all of us. And, you know, and I feel like by cultivating a common space that we can all gather, you know, that in a community with many divisions, I think that's very powerful.
That's Tanya Pulido, and she works at the 6th Street Gardens in Richmond. She's just won a Brower Youth Award for environmental activism. So, Tanya, how did you become an activist?
The way I became an activist, I was just, like I mentioned before, I barely graduated from high school. I wasn't doing...
From Richmond High.
Richmond High. In Richmond, yeah, Richmond High, our mascot is an oil funnel. You know, like, we're the Richmond Oilers, which just shows the power that the refinery has in the community. And, you know, I just, you know, the school, I don't even know how I graduated. I shouldn't have graduated, you know. I was doing really bad, and I wasn't, you know, I never imagined myself going to four-year college or anything like that. And, you know, and because of that, you know, because of my bad habits, I hit a lot of walls, and then it finally got to the point where I started questioning my existence. I was like, why am I here? What am I doing? You know? And then as I asked myself questions, I started seeking for answers. And then I started watching the news a little bit, and I started realizing the power of oil corporations in the U.S. and overseas. And then I was like, wow, you know, and then I started learning about specifically about Chevron and its facilities in Nigeria and other parts of the world, and just like the horrible practices that it was implying and the horrible humanitarian violations. And then I got really outraged. You know, it got to the point where I couldn't hold it any longer within me. I couldn't just sit down there and keep watching the news. It wasn't enough for me. And I feel like I had to go do something. So I just started contacting everyone I knew who was involved with social like justice and activism. And I met a lot of wonderful people.
And getting this Brower Award, how does that help your activism? How does that help you feel part of a sort of larger movement?
It definitely helps a lot because, you know, as a youth in a community, there's a lot of social activism going on in Richmond, but a lot of it is adults and elderly, you know. And when I went to meetings, I realized that most of the time I was the only young person there. In a lot of the Chevron meetings, a lot of, you know, all these other different meetings, community meetings, I was the youngest person there. So just being surrounded by youth who are passionate and are doing so many great things locally and globally is just so inspiring, and it definitely keeps me moving and keeps me motivated and inspired to continue going at this, you know, even stronger. You know, I want to go back and I want to like give it my all, you know, and just pour it all out. And I feel like I'm so grateful for this opportunity to be able to connect and network with so many youth.
Tanya Pulido is one of the winners of the 2011 David Brower Youth Awards. You can find this conversation at kalw.org. That's also where you can subscribe to our podcast. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. The team includes Audrey Dilling, Casey Miner, Nina Morente, Erica Mu, Joaquin Palomino, Rena Palta, Seth Samuel, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Our managing editor is Martina Castro, Ben Trefney is our executive editor, and Cross Currents theme music is provided by Oakland's John Santos Quintet. City CarShare provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City CarShare is online at citycarshare.org. And thanks to you. We are listener-supported radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.